Hi, I'm Roy Yannick. You're listening to the Improv Conspiracy Podcast and my episode titled, The Whole Show is Your Show.
The Improv Conspiracy Podcast with your host, Bronnie.
Hello there, everybody. It's the Improv Conspiracy Podcast with me, your host, Bronnie, and your friend. Pleased to see ya. Thanks for being ya. Pleasure's all mine to know ya. I don't know what this voice is, but it's just come on abruptly. I didn't expect it, and I best move on from it. Today on the show is a legend and a dear old friend of mine, Roy Yannick, the artistic director at the Hideout Theatre in Austin, also one of the founding members and persisting member of Parallelogramophonograph, along with Casey Beeler, Kareem Badger, and Valerie Ward. They are a troupe from Austin who have been together for 18 bloody years. And I think they've performed weekly in that time. I learned all this on this podcast. I knew they'd been together a long time, but 18 years shocked me. It's no wonder they've been together so long. They're all incredible improvisers in their own right. Together, they are more than the sum of their parts. They're lovely to work with. They're lovely to learn from. And they're lovely to watch. I've had the good fortune to do all three of those things. They also have a book on long-form narrative improv called Do It Now. It's a great book. I'll put a link to it in the show notes as well. This episode with Roy, he talks about The Whole Show is Your Show. It's a topic I didn't know he was bringing to the table. I didn't ask. He didn't tell. And he revealed it in the moment. And I was delighted because it is something I think about and care about and talk about in my classes. And so it just was perfect timing. I loved it. I'm going to leave it to Roy to kick it off. Here he is now. Please enjoy, everybody. He's back. His voice is back.
So what I'd like to talk about is the idea that the whole show is your show. And this is kind of like a mantra that I will tell cast or tell myself or tell other people. And what I mean by that is just that oftentimes you can get really hung up on how much you've done in a show and whether you've done enough or whether you've done too much and how much space you're leaving. In fact, I think we're often taught to leave space for other people, which is a very generous improv-y thing to do. But I think that is a suboptimal goal for you to have in a show or a troupe, a place where we're leaving space for each other. I think the optimum like kind of goal would be that everyone feels empowered to go for it at all moments, and that you have a level of trust and support with one another, that you know that if someone is on a tear, that we can let them be on a tear for a while and let them kind of run with the ball, as it were, and that they're not being greedy and taking up too much space, that they are just inspired in the moment. But it means so much more than that too. It also means that you're not limited to the character that you're playing. The type of improv I do tends to be, not exclusively, but the majority of the stuff I do is like an improvised narrative. And I think often we're taught as a shortcut in doing kind of narrative or storytelling in improv that you just play your character really hard and you play from their point of view, and then the story will take care of itself. But I think that also is limiting. And I think it is very fun to just improvise the whole story and to be like, oh, I know what happens next in the story, and I'm really inspired. And maybe I'll come out as a character I've never played before, and it's just really, literally a two-dimensional throwaway character, and it doesn't have to be fully fleshed out. I'm not going to play that character again, and we'll never see them again, but they serve a role in the story. And I think that that level of comfort and trust among the cast should be such that we feel comfortable laying stuff on each other's characters too. Because I think if you do get in that mindset of I'm just playing my character, I'm playing their point of view really strongly and nothing else matters, then you can also become super protective of those characters, and you also become very cautious with what you do to each other's characters. And so in the moment, I might have a hit that like the person I'm playing opposite has been depressed for a while, or they just got back from a convention or something like that. And if the whole show is my show, there's no problem with me doing that or putting or planning thoughts in their head or flashing back to add some context or color to their character, rather than being like, this is what I'm doing, that's what you're doing, and we need to stay kind of protected from one another. I love it when someone else tells me what's going on with my character, because it gives me permission to fully embody those things. I think there's always a level of judgment in my own brain if I come up with something for my character, or if someone else tells me that I'm crazy, or that I'm slightly psychotic, or that I killed three people, or that I'm a doctor who doesn't know what they're doing, then great. That's a huge gift that someone else has given my character, and I don't feel offended that they didn't give me the chance to figure that out. But this kind of, I mean, obviously there's all sorts of pitfalls in that kind of mentality, because if you have an inequality when it comes to the level of experience of performers that you have in your cast, or someone has status over the other players, then you can definitely wind up in situations where one person does just kind of steamroll the whole show and the other people are hanging back. But I think it's worth kind of talking about with your group and seeing what you could do to get to a level of trust where you can all improvise the whole show. And I think we'll probably get into this, but you can do explicit exercises where you play each other's characters, you swap characters, you make a goal that I'm going to play like six characters in the show so that I don't feel tied or grounded in just that one character, play big group scenes, play shared characters, play invisible characters, play all that fun stuff. So the whole show is your show. And I think the final point I'll make on that is that we are not only the actors in a show, obviously, but we're also the directors and the writers, but we're also the editors of the show in like the film editing sense. And what I mean by that is we decide how long a scene goes, and we decide what scenes are unnecessary that we leave on the cutting room floor. Since we're improvising moment to moment, we don't actually do that, but we do, if we do have the whole show in mind and we're not afraid to improvise the story of the show, then we can say, feel inspired to jump 20 years into the future. And I think often when we feel like improvising the plot is a bad idea or a bad word, then the next scene will just literally be like what follows chronologically as I leave the apartment, or like I talk to the next person that makes logical sense. So yeah, that's kind of my rant. I don't even know if I believe it.
I love this topic. I'm so glad I didn't know what you're going to talk about going in, and then you said something that has been on my mind for the last 6 months. Now, I'm fed up, personally. Melbourne improvisers are really polite.
Yeah.
The most timid and generous and kind people will like stunt their impulses for fear of like taking too much space. And I've started using the mantra of play for the note, like trust that I will tell you if you're doing too much. Cause I just wish people would like more often than not try to find the line of too much rather than like play in fear of hitting it. You said permission, which is really nice. Permission to just follow those impulses and take those chances and trust that your team will support you. But I also find, tell me what you think about this. I find that it also helps having that thought when you're on the sidelines to go like, I can't think about what my character is going to do next, because this scene that's happening right now is also technically my scene, even though I'm not in it.
Yes, yes, yes. 100%. I don't feel like I'm qualified to talk about The Herald, so I'm not going to dig too much into that. But I do think that if you're trained a lot in a Herald type structure, we're talking about like the training wheels, like know, very structured format, you can have this instinct of like, I just did my scene and so I'm good for like the next 7 minutes, you know? And like the scene that follows is the other people's responsibility. Now, I don't think like anyone with like a good coach or someone keeping an eye on the troop or a troop that can give each other notes well, like I don't think they would necessarily let that stand, but you could see how you could fall into that trap of like, I'm not going to support this scene because I just did my work. I'm going to stand off to the side. You know, I just have to wait. I have to wait for scene two to roll back around, you know?
That's it. Yeah. And I think the inner critic, whilst it's like the devil in terms of like people beating themselves up, I also think it's the devil in terms of like, I just did my scene. Some people laughed and let me just like go over it in my head again because that was exciting.
Yeah.
And so like, even when you're like, jazzed about your scene on the sidelines, you're like ripping yourself from the moment where you could be like, even just your attention is the most supportive thing you can do, right? To be attentive to what's happening so that you can go like, oh, Roy just said something real funny that I can make him say again in 10 minutes, you know?
I absolutely think that even if the show doesn't call for a lot of side support, I think the best thing you can do if you're physically capable is when you're on the sides to remain standing and to lean in as if like you're about to jump onto the field of like a sport, some sort of sport, you know? And like I used to call it a sports ready stance, and I realized I didn't know what the hell I was talking about. So backed off that terminology. But I think people understand anyway. You're literally kind of standing and leaning forward towards the stage with like your hands on your legs, and you're like, at any second I could go. And part of the reason for that is there's another phrase you probably heard called like follow your feet. And literally it's just that, and I first heard this from a book called Acting on Impulse by Carol Hazenfeld. It's a really amazing book. And she said, you know, it's like oftentimes literally your body knows you want to move before your conscious brain can have the thought, and you can see it as a coach, or if you're a director watching on the outside, you'll see people do this like stutter step where their body starts moving and then they second guess themselves and they step back. And so the thing about standing and being leaning forward is that it removes the barrier of you having to stand up and then move forward, like you are ready to go at any possible moment. Now, obviously, if you're tired or if you're over 40, like, you know, I just say that because I'm 46.
Yeah.
Then you know, have a seat. It's like I'm not going to shame anyone for taking care of themselves, but I think to the extent that you're ready, like lean in and be ready to go. You know,
I it's so easy to forget where the things you learn came from. But I've just, as you just said all of that, I'm reminded how influenced by you I am. Cause I remember you saying that in, a workshop, in Melbourne in like 2014. And I've had the philosophy ever since because I watch it, in our theater, there's two very thin wings, sort of like you're just sort of standing on the side of the stage and, people like lean their butts up against the wall. And you can just see like the impulse has to travel their foot to their butt. And then it feels like the wall just absorbs all the energy. And then they do that thing, the stutter step. And also what I think happens is the audience sees that. And then the scene that's on stage might as well be over because like, everyone's looked at the person who denied the impulse and then like, oh, something was supposed to happen but didn't, and now I'm no longer caring about what's happening on stage because I'm more interested in the human aspect of this show. I want to talk about etiquette in terms of like, you know, Roy stepped out first, so I'm gonna wait for Roy to speak before I do anything, and that's my rule forever, no matter what. Like, what are your thoughts?
Okay, so I do have a thought about that, which is that I think inspiration is like the fire that can fuel a whole show. Well, God, there's so much to say. I love it. Like, this conversation is going to be over before I feel like I've warmed up into this topic. It always happens in a podcast. Let me back up. My personal philosophy is that there are three types of shows. There's a show that went badly. There's a show that was effortless. And there's a show that was good, but was a little bit of work. And so I think the only way you get an effortless show is if you follow a spark of if inspiration has the opportunity to flourish. And so what I would say about the etiquette of who starts a scene is, if someone jumped out on stage to start the scene, you should probably give them two or three lines to get out their idea. And then after that, it might be clear that they just felt the impulse to wipe the previous scene and they actually have nothing. And if you have something, then great. Then we'll follow your spark of inspiration. Mm-hmm. But the last thing I want to do is have someone be so inspired that their feet move. They have an idea, and then I blurt out something that completely nullifies their joy. And I do it out of nervousness or fear, you know?
Yeah.
I don't know. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, so I agree in that I think it's nuanced. I just think some people go like, oh, Roy stepped out first, so I will never step on that. But it's like, I think you need to read the player and go like, is this an idea that Roy's trying to get out, or is Roy just on stage because the stage needed to be have someone on it? And if I can read that correctly, that like that's the intention, to go like, are we just filling this stage right now, or did Roy come on for a specific purpose? If so, I'll wait for that.
And I think you can always immediately start emotionally reacting to the other person. I don't think you need to wait on them to do that. I think you can also read whatever their face is conveying, and you can make comments on that. Like, I think emotion is another axis on the scene. I've lost my visual metaphor that never was fully formed in my head, but I think it's orthogonal to the other elements of the scene. And so I think that emotion, you can always start improvise. Like, you're not going to ruin anything in the other person's idea, unless they had a very, very specific idea as to what they wanted to happen in the scene. And honestly, if they did, it's on them to get it out immediately.
Yeah. I guess where it shows up that that troubles me is when etiquette just causes the improviser who's like operating via etiquette to just wait instead of what you're saying, which is like be invested right away, but still in a way that's like passive and yesing rather than yes ending.
Honestly, this is something that I think just happened after like doing improv for too long, but we're now like, especially in the 4-person group I play with, Parallelogram and Phonograph, we're at the point where we will just tell each other on stage when you've stepped on my toes. I mean, you know what I mean? Like, there's no, we show all the strings now. So it would just literally be like, hold up, I had an idea, you know? And then it'd be like, oh, my bad. And then you like basically start the scene over. So, and you know, that's a very specific type of show. If your goal is to make something that looks like, it could be a scripted play, you know, that like if an audience member walked in, they wouldn't know the difference, and that you're hitting like a genre like really hardcore, then obviously there's not room for that like direct banter. But if you trust each other enough and you're not doing that, then you can just work stuff out, and then the audience enjoys being led into the process.
I remember the one and only show I have done with you guys. It was like there was a murder or something, and then the second scene was in a police precinct, and I just tried to match all your accents, and you straight away went, "Hold on, Sergeant, where are you from?"
Yeah, what a jerk move. Should not have done that. I mean, I'm sure I had fun doing it, but like,
oh yeah, we all did.
But you're just doing your best, and I had to call it out and be a jerk about it.
It's one of my fondest memories, truly.
Okay, good. Then never mind. It was genius.
You touched on something something else I want to talk about. You referenced real life status, within a troop. And I have felt that over time in certain situations. And I want to know how you navigate it, because you are still, I assume, the AD at the hideout.
Yeah.
And I have literally seen, there was a person I bumped into in New York who we chatted about improv in the line at UCB. And then a week later, he walked into the hideout and I was sitting with you, and he almost didn't want to bother you. And so I was like, oh, this is a very different experience with the same guy who we were just chatting as peers before. And now I'm sitting with Roy and he doesn't want to really like bother the table. And so definitely in that building, you have a type of status. And how have you navigated it with, like, obviously people you would have taught who, you know, much fresher than you, who then are on ensembles with you? What do you experience?
Yeah, it is hard. I don't know that I'll have any good answers, but I can definitely talk about it, which I think often I'm mostly in shows where I direct them or I am in charge of them in some ways. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of built in, and there's an ongoing debate. Like I said, at the Hideout, we do a lot of improvised narrative or genre work. And some directors feel very strongly that they shouldn't be in the show that they're directing. And some directors feel very strongly that they're spending all their time putting the show together that they want to do. And so, damn it, they're going to be in it.
Yeah.
And I fall into that camp, which you probably could have guessed. And, I think I cheat. I think I cheat every time. So I will put myself in the role where I'm literally the host of the show or the director or the narrator or something like that. So that, the status difference is baked in and it's explicit. I think the times when I've been a cast member, it has been harder. It hasn't been any recently, but I was in a show that Casey was directing about, it was like an improvised bonanza, like 1960s cowboy Western TV show. And it was really fun. And there were some very experienced players in there, but like all of our big shows at the Hideout, we also try to have some newer performers in.
Yeah.
And I think I literally got the note in scene from somebody that I was doing too much, you know?
Wow.
And it was they were joking about it. They were like, well, that guy never really stops talking, does he? So I don't know that I have a good answer. It's hard. It is tricky to navigate, but I think like anything, the important thing is that you try to create a space where everyone can feel free to talk about their experience afterwards, not necessarily give each other notes, but at least say like, I was trying to do this thing in this one scene and I felt like I couldn't get in, you know, or like, I didn't know what to do because I was in the scene with you and you know what you're doing. So I just felt like I would hang back. And like you're not always going to get that. People aren't always going to feel that comfortable giving that sort of feedback, but you do your best. And even as a director, I'll tell people, if you have something coming up that's like holding you back, I'd rather, like, please tell me and we'll work it out. I'd rather know now than to find out 2 years from now when I can't do anything about it.
Yes, exactly.
But yeah, no, it's tricky. And I think the more general issue of like, if you're putting together an ensemble that explicitly has people that have been doing improv for 15 years and people that have been doing it for 2 years, you know, because you don't want to closed ecosystem and you want to keep, you want to give people opportunities to perform, then you run into all that stuff I was talking about in the rant of like, you know, ideally the whole show is your show and everyone is stepping up, but people are hanging back and trying to be polite. I had one show that I was directing, and I'll try not to name names, but there was an explicit setup where we would precast someone to be the main character every night. It was just the type of genre where there'd be a single protagonist. And I think our fear was that if we didn't do that, the more experienced players would grab that role every night. And then the less experienced players would have a subpar experience because they never got a chance to try that. Mm-hmm. And so we precast those roles. But what would happen is someone with less experience, even though they were a delightful improviser, in the moment when their character needed to express like a strong desire or make a strong decision, they would like either freeze up or waffle or like debate. Mm-hmm. And then the person with more experience would like try to give them space and then would swoop in and like make and propel the story forward.
Yeah.
And then like later we would get like feedback that like, oh, so-and-so is steamrolling, you know?
Mm.
And that was that, like that whole experience really crystallized that for me, that like, I think the, like from my perspective watching it, because that was the show I didn't play in, I could see everything go down. I could see the newer performer doing their best but being a little nervous, and I could see the experienced performer on the side going, "Come on, come on, come on, come on! I got to do something," you know. And it was tricky, and so I think that really crystallized for me that, like, no, I think the skill to work on is to bring everyone up to the level where they do feel comfortable making big moves. And then if they don't, also putting an onus on the people with more experience to invite people with less experience in. Mm-hmm. So a lot of times in those bigger ensemble shows, if someone is really excited or someone has that spark of inspiration to come on stage, we'll tell them explicitly, like, when you do that, grab somebody and bring them on with you to at least just like mirror what you're doing, you know? Yeah, and then you can be like two brothers that come on to like, you know, give the protagonist a hard time. So it's kind of like you're inviting someone to share the fun idea that you just had so that it evens out like the stage time issue a little bit. I don't know if that addressed your question.
No, it did. Yeah. I just think it's probably a problem that exists in perpetuity. As you said, to keep an ecosystem open, you're always going to have that difference in experience.
I think one of the things you can do is if you're aware of it, you can really just try to almost offer nothing. These are more for isolated scenes, but like literally you just put yourself in the mode of, I'm going to yes and the shit out of whatever my scene partner with less experience is doing, and like basically treat them. And I mean, it's a good model in general. It's just treat them like everything they're doing is genius and that you're there to like amplify it, you know?
In the time that I've been doing improv, I've had both experiences where I'm deferring to someone because I'm worried about treading on their superior experience. And then I've had instances where I can feel that that's happening to me, and in the latter, I'm always like, my soul is screaming for like, I'm as open to you as you are to me. Like, I'm happy for you to be in control right now, and also I know way less than you think I know about this scene right now. Like,
yeah, absolutely. Yeah, 100%. Like, just because you've been doing it forever doesn't mean you know what the hell's going on in any given moment. Yeah, 100%. And that's why, and for me in particular, I play with the same three people for 90% of my shows. And so oftentimes I'll trick myself into thinking I'm a better improviser than I am. And then I play with a different assortment of people and I'm like, oh, I'm just good at playing with those other three people.
The last little topic I think I want to cover before I'm going to have to get you on again, because I feel like you want to keep talking and I want to keep talking to you.
I feel like we are 10 minutes into this conversation. It happened again. That's the worst.
Yeah. the permission that you get from an audience that is, when you are given an idea rather than you having one, you sort of touched on this, like being given the gift of being crazy, for example, you said, I find that like the contract with the audience is very different and you have a lot more rope when they can see that you were told that you are something and now yeah. you're playing that something at 100%. That's very different and you'll have much more grace from an audience, even if it's like a, you know, villainous bad sort of thing, versus when you bring that idea to the table yourself.
I think that's true. And I think that's part of why over time I've liked to show the audience like the inner workings of improv as much as possible. Because I've really come to think that, like, I mean, this isn't mind blowing or anything, but it's the unique part of performance improv is that it's they're witnessing the act of creation in the moment. And I think you're right. I think like if it comes just from me, like a crazy idea I had, then it can feel like, oh, maybe he already had that, or he's just showboating or whatever. But if someone else lays it on top of me, then they're like, oh, what's he gonna do with this? Even though like we don't necessarily feel that way, you know? And even if I come up with an idea on my own, like it's because I was inspired by something that someone else is doing. So to me, they're already giving me that offer, but I do like sometimes when it's explicit. Yeah, there's that whole idea of this is maybe is only tangentially related, but I did want to mention it. There was a blog post by Bill Arnett years and years ago where he talked about the idea of the. It basically was phrased as, "We've all done twice as many shows as we think we've done." This is the standard speech. You may have heard this in 20 whenever we were there. And there's the show you're trying to do, whether it be the Herald or improvised Dickens or a montage or whatever. And then there's the show of a bunch of people on stage having a good time.
Yeah.
And we've come to call that in at the Hideout the second show. So if we say the second show, people will know what that means. And I think it's a better framing than just say like, oh, you went really meta in that scene, because that's not the... It can look the same, but it's not the same. So if there's a show of a bunch of people on stage having a good time, and I would also argue a show of a bunch of people on stage creating the show they're trying to create, then I think you could switch between those shows and they serve each other. So once we have that framework, it became much easier to just pop out of the first show for a second and say like, what was your character's name? Oh, it was Mary. Okay. And then you could pop back into the first show and everyone knows you're back in the first show and you say like, hey, Mary, rather than I'm going to spend the entire show avoiding saying your character's name because I can't remember it, or I'm going to call you by the wrong name and then we have to justify why your character has two names, which is funny for like three years of improv and then you never want to do it again.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that framing of the second show, I think, can be a valuable place to hang things on that, of like the audience seeing that someone else, your friend on stage, laid this thing on you, and you're not 100% comfortable with it, but you go for it, you go 110% for it anyway.
Yeah.
They're enjoying it. They're enjoying the second show at that moment. And I think sorry, I know we're probably running out of time, but... The other thing about that is when you're creating a new show, it provides a good metric for what your target is. So like the improvised Chekhov show that we did at the Hideout years ago, the director's goal was no second show at all, 100% first show. And so if you broke on stage and you laughed, the direction was immediately roll that back into why your character laughed. You know, where as opposed to some other shows, weirdly, the duo I have with the guy who directed that show, our show is like almost all second show and the scene work was secondary, you know, and it was literally us having a good time on stage, Daffy Duck style, you know, just like throwing everything against the wall. And then a lot of shows, most shows fall somewhere in between that. So it'll be, you're doing an improvised romantic comedy, but part of it is that the tropes are so ridiculous. And so the performers on stage are really relishing leaning into how dumb those tropes are, you know?
Yeah.
But like with everything, knowing you're doing that explicitly, I think gives you a better control over it and makes everything more intentional.
Three things, actually. One, I've been talking about that Chekhov show ever since I saw it. I tell people in Melbourne it's easily the best improv I've ever seen in my life. It was so, so good. And that's so cool to hear. And also the second thing is, again, I reckon I got show the I talk about show one and show two, and I reckon that's from you. Because I have the same philosophy and I don't know where else I would have got it except from you. Yeah. No, so I love that. Again, thank you. Thank you for inspiring me and influencing me. There's a duo here called Cool and Smart. And there's my duo Swing Set, and we don't think that we're the same in any way, but we do. I taught both the guys in Cool and Smart, and they both talk about show one, show two as well. And the one distinction that we know exists between our two shows is that Swing Set, my show, leans more show one with like a dabble of show two, and theirs is almost the opposite. Theirs is much more show two focused, leaning every now and then to show one. It's a lovely way to think about it. And I think
that's a wild thing. That whole thing, which is like infused a lot of the work we do at the Hideout and with Parallelogram of Phonograph, probably made its way from us to you, all comes from like a blog post on Bill Arnett's like website. And I think he may have been even relating like a concept that somebody else, that he learned from somebody else, you know?
Yeah,
and it's
these
tenuous connections. And I think a lot of times, especially if you write like an article on your website, you're just like, no one's ever gonna read this. It had this massive influence, you know, that spanned like decades.
Absolutely.
And it's incredible. Not like it's new, it's a new idea, but it's the way it was framed was very new to me, and for me it became very useful. Also, I don't know why I was being coy about saying his name. The guy who directed that show is John Bolden, and we should give him a shout out.
Yeah, hell yeah, John. It ruled. The other thing that just came up in that little thing you were talking about, when you said saying the wrong name and then figuring out why you have two names and that being fun for 3 years, one of the things I struggle with as a teacher, like I think I know which is the right thing to do, and it's the thing that I do, which is I let the students who do those things, I let them experience it and have it. I don't shout it down and go like, don't do that. But everything in my being is like, oh, that's not fun. It's not funny. Because I obviously am past that 3 years point where I'm like, yeah, that's a fun improv thing that's come up. And yes, it's funny to deal with, but I'm done with it. Where do you stand with like teaching someone and something that is like the most cliche improv thing that happens? Mm-hmm. What do you do? Do you go like, oh, we try to avoid that? Or do you let it play out and have them have the same experience as you, or what?
Now that you bring it up, I feel like I should probably just bite my tongue and not say anything.
Oh, so you do say something?
But I think I say exactly what we just were saying. I tell them like, that was really funny and it will get a laugh and you will enjoy doing it for 3 years. And I was like, but also names are really hard and you don't have to do that. And then there's the whole name speech, which is just that as soon as a name is said, you should say it at least 5 times or it's like it was never said. And then you still only have 50-50 chance of remembering it. Yeah. And then also that I'm totally cool with you pausing the show and asking each other what name people had. But I don't expressly forbid anyone from doing anything.
Right.
But I do think, but now that you mention it, I'm like, even just giving that speech, they would probably be like, oh, it's not cool to do that. And I'm like, I don't know. They should have fun for 3 years. Because honestly, if the audience is new to improv, they will also enjoy that. It's just us old curmudgeons that are over it.
Yeah, because it's hard to find. Like, I sometimes feel like a curmudgeon in the audience of a theater. When two improvisers start talking at the same time, I'm like, God, I've seen it 4 million times. But then, like, the audience is having a great time, and the two performers are having a great time. You know, when they're doing that thing.
What do you mean talking at the same time?
When they're like, you know, we're twins and we talk at the same.
Time,
and we always think. And they're talking slowly, trying to guess each other's words, and like everyone's loving it. The performers are loving it, but I'm sitting there going, "I've seen it, I've done it. It's boring."
That's not one of my. That doesn't bother me.
Yeah, okay.
I think because usually when it happens, it only happens for like a couple of seconds, and then we move on. But there are some other fun tricks that I thought you were talking about people. Literally talking over each other, like, and that could be really fun. Anyway, total side tangent. We've talked a lot about the Hideout and my group Parallelogram and Phonograph, so I just want to give a shout out to the rest of P-Graph, which is Kareem Bajra, Casey Beeler, and Valerie Ward, lifelong friends at this point. Casey realized the other day that she's been doing improv with P-Graph for half of her life. So,
whoa, that's crazy.
Because we've done over 18 years of shows together, and she's like 36. So, you know, there you go.
18 years of shows. That's in. Do you know how many? Roughly?
We stopped counting at, roughly we're at about 1,500, but we kind of stopped counting around 700. Yeah.
That's so cool. That's the best. I talk about taking classes with you guys all the time. One of my favorite Kareem memories that I always tell people when they do this behavior, but it was someone dropped to their knees on the stage.
He came
running down from the top of the theater. He wasn't even like he wasn't even leading the session at the time. He came running down. He's like, "No comedy scene is worth your knees." And I've never forgotten it.
We will all give that speech, and because I think we all did it when we were first starting out. And someone else told us that. And I can picture that so clearly because Kareem was probably hanging out in the back so that he didn't, so that all of P-Graph wasn't all talking at once. So he'll like physically hang out in the back. And then he heard that and he's like, "I got to get this in."
It ruled.
It's true. It's true. Improv. It's kind of expanded that over the years to just be like, improv isn't worth it sometimes, you know?
Yeah,
and that's one of the things improv is not worth.
Yeah. Well, it was a great teaching moment. If it had come from any of the three of you who were leading the session at the time, it wouldn't have stuck in my brain, but it was his sprint from the back.
Yeah.
He came storming down, and I'll never forget it. And I've said it.
Oh, yeah. It's great. It's very true. It's very true. That much stuff will mess you up.
Now for a practical nugget.
I feel like I have all these set speeches, but this speech in particular is just a tiny bit of wisdom that we got from Three for All, which is a three-person group back in the day. They're an incredible group. Stephen, Kieran, Tim Orr, and Rafe Chase. And P-Graph, Parallelogram and Phonograph, we learned a lot from them back in the day. But one of the things I think Stephen Kieran said during an intensive we took was just, have the long view about everything and just assume you're going to be doing this for like 20 plus years. And if you do have the long view on it, then what does it matter if you played like a stupid character like 3 weeks in a row or you had two off shows? That's like the tiniest blip in your overall improv performance. And I really like that. And it helped tremendously because I think when you're first starting out, especially, like, I don't know about you, but like the first couple of years I was doing improv, every show felt like life or death. And if a show went badly, I beat myself up about it for like way too long.
Yeah.
And so starting to have the long view on that stuff is good. And the thing that was added to that, and I think this either came from them or was very quickly tacked onto that, was imagine like the quality of your shows is like a line graph over time. And it's like, you might have like dips and like peaks. And some of the dips might last for quite a while, but like the overall trend is upwards, you know? And if you could take, I had a minor in math, it's been a while, but if you took the integral I don't know. If you computed the if you just drew a straight line, it would be pointing up. And so the quality of your shows is improving over time, but you're just seeing like the tiniest part of the graph where it's all over the place, you know. And I think that stuff's useful to have the long view. The other, just to throw in one more nugget of wisdom, would just be to slow down. Whatever, whoever you are, whatever you're doing, you can slow down in your scene work. And I needed that advice very badly. I was a very manic performer when I first started.
All right, I'm going to get us a word from a word generator, and then we're just going to see what happens for 2 minutes or so.
Okay.
The word is hurricane.
I'm ready.
Yeah, it's really, you know? It's really building up out there. But I think we've done all we can do.
Yeah, I got the markers.
Good. I got a couple of belts. I got a couple of belts we can tie us.
Yeah, great. If we need. You seem a little nervous.
Yeah, look, if I'm honest, I'm trying to feed off your readiness, but there's a part of me that just feels like this might be the one that takes me.
Baxter, you know how many hurricanes I've been through?
You keep telling me, 35. You keep telling me.
35 hurricanes. There was Alicia. There was Harold. There was Delilah. There was Howard. Yep. There was Harriet. Yep. Yeah. There was Kyle. There was Larry. There was Marvin. There was Nathan. There was Omar.
I know. Peterson, Billy's in there. Yep. Colin. They're all in my black book here. I know them all. I recite them all before I go to bed. Don't you worry. I try to psych myself into this, but I'm just not you, okay?
I think that's, Baxter, I know. I mean, it can be scary, but it's also an opportunity for arts and crafts, you know? So we light the candles. We get out the markers, you know? And if you're not feeling creative, you can just color in the pictures in the magazine. And if you are feeling creative, you can use a blank sheet of paper.
Yeah, okay. I just find it hard to access my true creativity when I'm fearing that I might die. That's all.
I just think so often we're married to our phones, you know, and now but when the power goes out and the internet's down and you might die, well, you can do one of two things. You could strap yourself to the wall with a belt.
Yes, please. Was your plan. Please. Yeah.
Or you can do some macrame or make some macaroni art or, you know, color in a little piece of paper.
Okay, what's your plan for today? What are you gonna make?
Well, first I thought I would draw a picture of every hurricane that I've witnessed. You know how many hurricanes I've sat through?
I know, 35.
There was Alicia. Barry,
and Harold. And Delilah. I know they're all there. You're just gonna draw them again because they're plastered all over the bathroom already. Do we need another picture of them, or do you reckon?
I'm just trying to get through this, you know. It used to be hurricane season, you'd only see maybe one, two hurricanes, but you know, now we get an average of 5 a year, you know.
Well, I can't help that I'm not used to it yet. Okay, I can't help that I moved here from a you know, generally wind-free state.
Yeah, well, there's fewer and fewer of those now, you know. That's 2035. True. Yeah.
Yeah.
Baxter, if we're going to die, you know, it's our time.
Yeah. I just
We've outlived a lot of people. We have outlived a lot of people.
There's a lot of things I want to do still. I want to I want to dig more in the backyard if I could.
Well, now's not a good time for that, but
no, I know.
I guess we could. We could throw open the back door and go through the security perimeter and just start digging.
Yeah. Well, I would love that. I'm I'm trying to get a deeper hole so I can put more of my belongings in it. And because that's what I mean, my long term plan is be inside a bunker at this sort of time and leave you to do your crafts up here, because I don't really want to be a part of that.
Well, you know, I feel like a bunker should be saved for something more serious.
You don't think you really are? You've really been changed by those 35 hurricanes, haven't you?
Oh, you remembered how many I've been through. There was Alicia, was Harold, there was Delilah,
I know. Kyle, Nigel, Colin. They're all there. They're all in the bathroom ad infinitum. Okay, I know. Stop it. Stop it. I've had enough.
All right. Well, if you want me to strap you to the wall, then sure. But I don't see how that's going to help. I think you actually want to be kind of mobile if the wall crashes open and a tornado comes in.
I have my methods. You have yours.
I guess so.
There you have it, my friends. That is the podcast for this time around. My thanks to Roy. My thanks to Tiana Hogben for the voiceovers. This show was produced, mixed, edited by me, Bronny, with original music by me, Bronny. I always feel stupid saying that, but you got to give credits where credits are due. Have a good one, everybody.
Thanks for listening to the Improv Conspiracy Podcast. If you enjoyed the show, we'd love for you to take a moment to rate and review us on your preferred service. 5 stars, please.